A videotaped interview with the president on his first 2 years in office with Sander Van Oker, NBC, George Herman, CBS, and Bill Lawrence of ABC for later release. From the president's office in the White House, December 16, 1962. This recording is section 3 of 3 sections and contains all statements made available for network use and is not edited.
Sir, do you reach a point where you have to say, Fisher, cut bait, I can't go to the American people and ask them to assume this burden if they know that you're going to do this? For example, the Skyboat.
Well, look at the Skyboat. The United States has developed the Skyboat. We put in $350 million into Skyboat. No other country has put anything into the actual manufacture of Skyboat. If we completed it, the British would have bought 100 missiles. We would have bought 1,000. It would have cost $2.5 billion. We today pay 30% of the infrastructure costs of NATO, the supply lines, the depots in Europe. It costs us about $3 billion in our balance of payments. The aid we give around the world is, the American people are very critical, and the American press prints a lot of bad news because bad news is news and good news is not news. And so they get an impression always that the United States is not doing its part. When I just think of what we've done for 15 years since 45, the countries we sustain, the alliances of which we're the center, the willingness of the United States to accept burdens all around the world, I think it's a fantastic start. We got 1 million Americans today serving outside the United States. There's no other country in history that's carried this kind of a burden. Other countries have had forces serving outside their own country, but for conquest. We have 2 divisions in South Korea, not to control South Korea, but to defend it. We have a lot of Americans in South Vietnam. Well, now, no other country in the world has ever done that since the beginning of the world. Greece, Rome, Napoleon, and all the rest always had conquest. We have 1 million men outside, and they're trying to defend these countries. Now what we are saying is that rich Western Europe must do its part. Now, I hope it will.
Nothing a president ever says is without effect, Mr. Kennedy. Aren't you sure that these words that you've just uttered will come back to you when appropriations bills start through the Congress, that you'll hear yourself?
No, I think the American people ought to know what they're doing, and I think Western Europe, success, after all, represents the greatest success of American foreign policy of the last, since World War II, the rebuilding of Europe. It's just what we want. They're bound to have differences of opinion with us, but all we ask Western Europe to do is not look in and just become a rich, careful, secluded group, but to play their role in this great world struggle as we've done it. We're going to continue to do it in the United States, but we ought to recognize how much we've done and not always be feeling. Whenever I read a dispatch from Europe, it's usually rather critical, even in the Skyboat stories that come out about how critical of the United States. My goodness, we've done a tremendous job in this country.
But can they play their role without developing their own nuclear weapons and their own nuclear deterrent? And is
they
that partly against
mind.
Our policy to have this proliferation?
Well, we don't want 6 or 7 separate nuclear powers in Europe diverting their funds to nuclear power when the United States has got this tremendous arsenal. But if these countries want to do it, we're not stopping them from doing it. We're not opposed. If the French decide they want to become a nuclear power themselves, that's their decision. The question is whether the United States should join in helping make France a nuclear power, and then Italy, then West Germany, then Belgium. How does that produce security when you have 10, 20, 30 nuclear powers who may fire their weapons off under different conditions? That isn't in our interest or in my interest, the interest of peace or the interest of Western Europe, and it's awfully expensive. Why duplicate what we've already done and are doing in Western Europe today, as long as our guarantees are good?
Mr. President, when you took office nearly 2 years ago, you said that we had to look for worse days before there would be better days. If the tide has turned, what do you consider your one single achievement that gave you the most satisfaction and the one single event that caused you the most disappointment?
Well, I'm not sure the tide has turned because I think that when we're in struggle with a system and countries as powerful as the Sino-Soviet bloc, there are bound to be setbacks, and we're going to have them in the coming years. As far, of course, the greatest disappointment was the disaster of April 1961 in Cuba, and I suppose our greatest satisfaction was when we had a withdrawal of the offensive missiles in Cuba a year or so later. I must say that it's hard to make a determination that some things are successes and some are failures, because each success brings with it the potential of failure, and each failure brings with it the potential of success. For example, the Dominican Republic We saw a transition from a dictatorship to a democracy. The dictatorship was wholly unsatisfactory. The democracy now is fraught with difficulties and perils in a poor country which is about to have an election. So that, as I say, when you have a success, which the transition was a success, now we have all the problems of making it work, the Dominican people, we do, and we're supporting them. What's true there is true in every country in the world. So I don't think we can ever say the job is done. I don't think we can ever say something is a success. I don't think we should ever say that something is a failure.
Mr. President, during the Cuban crisis, there was some problem, which you're apparently familiar with and bored with by now, about the possibility of a president talking in very private and secret conversations with his advisors, and that somehow leaking out. Do you think that this is going to inhibit the free, frank flow of advice that every president has to have?
No, I think it's unfortunate when there's sort of conversations, but there are, 1,300 reporters accredited to the White House alone. There are, I suppose, 100 or 150 people who are familiar with what goes on because in the Security Council meetings, in one way or another, you've got the people who are actually there, and you've got others who are given instructions as a result of the decisions there, and I suppose people do talk, and then as I said at the time of the Cuban disaster of April 61, that success has 100 fathers and defeats an orphan. I suppose when something goes well, there's more tendency to talk at all levels. And frequently the reports are inaccurate. I would say the security is pretty good at the National Security Council. It's unfortunate when it's breached.
You once said that you were reading more and enjoying it less. Are you still as avid a newspaper reader, magazine? I remember those of us who traveled with you on the campaign, a magazine wasn't safe around you.
Oh, it is. No. I think it's invaluable, even though it may cause you some... it's never pleasant to be reading things frequently that are not agreeable news, but I would say that it's an invaluable arm of the presidency as a check, really, on what's going on in administration. And more things come to my attention that cause me either concern or give me information. So I would think that Mr. Khrushchev, or operating a totalitarian system, which has many advantages as far as being able to move in secret and all the rest, there's a terrific disadvantage not having the abrasive quality of the press applied to you daily to an administration.
When you have...
Even though we never like it, and even though we don't even though we wish they didn't write it, and even though we disapprove, there isn't any doubt that we couldn't do the job at all in a free society without a very, very active press. Now, on the other hand, the press has the responsibility not to distort things for political purposes, not to just take some news in order to prove a political point. Seems to me their obligation is to be as tough as they can on administration, but do it in a way which is directed towards getting as close to the truth that they can get, and not merely because of some political motivation.
Well, now, you have a great many publishers in for luncheons. Many of them are, the majority of them, are of a different political persuasion.
Yes, I think that's a fair statistic.
When you are through with the luncheon, what do you think you've accomplished? Do you really think
what I'm trying to do is give them some understanding of what the problem is of the president. They write about it every day. Their papers do. They comment. They say what we ought to do. And I think frequently they're not aware of the difficulties that whoever is here has in meeting his responsibilities. My effort is to try to show them something about what goes on. I said this poem at a recent publisher's meeting about, which was a poem by an Italian, by a Spanish bullfighter, which bullfight critics ranked in rows, crowd the enormous plaza full, but only one is there who knows, and he's the one who fights the bull. I'm trying to get them in the bull ring, too.
President, even without this abrasive factor in the American press, do you have enough of that very valuable commodity, the no man, inside your own ranks in the administration? Do you have enough people who argue with you, who say, Mr. President, I think you're totally wrong, and is this at all jeopardized by this recent leak?
No, I think there's enough debate, and as I say, a combination of that and the press. There's a great myth around that the president just hears good things. That is one of the most inaccurate. In the first place, when you get it every morning in Intelligence Digest, it's always the critical points in the world. They never say things are very good in Tunisia. It's always what is wrong, because some action is usually required. So therefore, beginning really with the morning papers and the Intelligence Digest, you really are dealing usually with bad news all the time. So that I've never understood this view that the president's surrounded in such a way that he gets a rather rose-tinted. I think the fact the reverse may be true.
Mr. President, if you look at the arsenal of powers that are available to you as president, both domestic and foreign, are there changes that you would make? I'm thinking now, President Eisenhower, for example, favored a more direct role for his vice president. He favored a four-year term for congressmen, members of the House. Do any of these ideas appeal to you as the sort of thing that would go with your office and perhaps
strengthen? Well, the four-year term of the congressman has some advantages. It's pretty tough for Congress. The problems are so complicated. The hearings are quite long now. We deal with matters which every week, which, you know, just make the problems of the 19th century seem awfully simple. And they went on year after year, the same problems in the 19th century. Now it's monetary, fiscal policy, space, defense, and all the rest. So Congressman's elected, and he's almost having to look at the next election. So there's some four-year term, but I have some sympathy for. On the other hand, that's a very basic part of our Constitution. And whether the Congress and the country would be interested in changing, I don't know. It keeps them close to the people, but I think it makes the job of getting things done more complicated. The vice president plays an active role here through the National Security Council and as an advisor and counselor, as well as, of course, his responsibilities to the Senate. I think the system, generally, I don't see any changes. It's really just a question of how effectively the president uses the powers of his office. His powers in foreign policy, as I've said, are great. Domestically, they're quite circumscribed. The powers of the office are great, but the problems facing the office are almost greater. So there's never a sense of complete control of events because events are moving in such a rapid way and in such a varied way and so in such a worldwide way that you never have a feeling of dominance, but rather that it's always a struggle to stay even with events. How can the United States determine, for example, Laos, so many thousand miles away, entirely different country, trying to organize and sustain a government? We get so discontented with our policy in Laos or some other place, but it's very difficult for this one country with a very rich country, but still only a small percentage of the world's population, to make our writ run in the case of independent countries.
As a young congressman, sir, you voted to impose a two-term limitation on presidents. Now that you've held the office for a while and also observed its effect on President Eisenhower's second term, would you repeat that vote even if the amendment did not apply to yourself?
Yes, I would. I would. I know the conditions were special in 47. But I think 8 years is enough. And I'm not sure that a president, if he's, in my case, if I were reelected, that you're at such a disadvantage. There aren't many jobs. That isn't the power of the presidency, patronage at all. That's their field in the first month. Most of those jobs belong to the members of the Congress anyway. So patronage isn't a factor. I think there are many other powers of the presidency that run in the second term as well as the first.
Well, Mr. President, on that point,
the fact is President Eisenhower has great influence today in the Republican Party and therefore in the country, and has great influence in foreign policy. He doesn't even hold office. In some ways, his influence is greater to some degree. So that, and the same is really true of also of President Truman, President Hoover. I don't think that it depends on the influence of a president. It's still substantial in his second term, though I haven't had a second term. I think it is.
Are you looking forward to one, sir?
Mr.
President, on that point, much of your program still remains to be passed by the Congress. There are some people who say that you either do it in the next 2 years or it won't be done should you be elected to a second term. Do you share that point of view?
You know, in the first place, I think we've got a lot by. I was looking at what we set out to do in January 61 the other day and on taxes and on Social Security welfare changes and area redevelopment, minimum wage, the Peace Corps, the Alliance for Progress, the Disarmament Agency, and strengthening the defenses, strengthening our space program. We did all those things, the trade bill, not perhaps to the extent in every case of our original proposal, but substantial progress. I think we can do some more the next 2 years. And I would think that there are going to be new problems in 60, if I were reelected in 65, and I don't look at the second term as necessarily a decline. I don't think that at all. In fact, I think you know much more about the position. It's a tremendous change to go from being a senator to being president. In the first months, it's are very difficult. But I have no reason to believe that a president with the powers of this office and the responsibilities placed on it, if he has a judgment that some things need to be done, and he can do it just as well the second time as the first, depending, of course, on the makeup of the Congress.
Sir, your experience in both houses Does that sometimes make you too acutely conscious of their problems rather than having a fixation, as it were, on your own problem of president? Do you sometimes see too much their point of view?
No, I think I'm conscious from experience dealing with them as president that the Congress is, as I said before, it's very difficult to secure the passage of legislation, and we have to get the support of many members of Congress who may find it difficult in cases to vote with us. Look at the, particularly on domestic legislation, where powerful groups oppose any action you may take. We were dealing the other day with the problem of dairy surpluses. We spend $575 million a year for our dairy program. People on relief in the United States, public assistance, eat twice as much butter as the average American who is not on relief because we have so much butter. It's just pouring out. Well, now to try to write a program which will make sense and which will protect the interests of the farmer and still not cost us an staggering amount is very difficult. And there's so many places where you try to get a program through, and this happened last year, where you can be stopped by determined groups, even on the right committees or on the Appropriations Committee or on the Rules Committee. The fact is, I think the Congress looks more powerful sitting here than it did when I was there in the Congress. But that's because... when you're in Congress, you're one of 100 in the Senate or one of 435 in the House. So the power is so divided. But from here, I look at a Congress, and I look at the collective power of the Congress, particularly the block action, which it wants to, and it's a substantial power.
Presidents who have acquired a great measure of fame and eminence in our history are usually presidents who've had to seek ways around this blocking power that you speak of, I believe. Professor Clinton Rossiter says that if a president is not widely called in his own time a man who subverts the Constitution, he stands no chance of being a president known to history as a great president. If this is true, what have you been subverting lately?
I think that the final judgment of anybody in an administration in the 60s, and I think that that's the test, any other test, is have the vital interests of the United States been protected? Has peace been maintained? Is there greater stability in the world than when he came in? And secondly, at home, did the economic growth of the United States continue as it must to maintain reasonably full employment? Now, that is our problem for the 1960s. And did all citizens participate more fully in the life of the country? Now, that's what I'll rest on whenever I'm finished. And I think the Congress has a role to play, and so do we. But I make a longer-range judgment now because I think that my term of office, the last 2 years of President Eisenhower, was the beginning of the period where the Soviet Union had the power to inflict a very serious nuclear blow on the United States through missiles. Up till about 57 or 8, that wasn't true. So from 58 on, we've been operating with two very difficult problems. One is the fact the Soviet Union has the nuclear arsenal and means of delivery. And secondly, from the end of 57 on, we've had a slowdown in our economy and a constant 5 to 5.5 to 6% unemployment, a lag in our growth, flowing out of dollars. So we've had two very, very clear problems beginning really in 58. How we meet those two problems, it seems to me, will be our judgment.
You referred to the fact that it may not be particularly difficult to work on these problems in the administration to come if you run again and are elected again. But haven't you said that if history teaches us anything about the administrations of Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, for example, it's that they achieved their great things in the first weeks, months, and years, that is the time of maximum action. Do you think that is going to be the case?
No, because I think the problems are much different from the problems that faced Woodrow Wilson.
How so, sir?
Well, first, the world problem, which is an entirely different problem. After all, Franklin Roosevelt, until 1939, the Neutrality Act and isolation was our official foreign policy doctrine. Franklin Roosevelt made several speeches about it, but until the beginning, really, of the European War, the United States' influence was very marginal in the world. The good neighbor policy really consisted of not committing aggression against Latin America and of demonstrating a sympathy. Well, now we're much more involved all around the world, so that is the central responsibility of the president. And the second one, which is the domestic one, which he shares with the Congress under the Constitution, is one which is going to require work for the next 10 years to keep our economy moving. As I said, staggering number of people coming into the labor market at a time when their need for them, I think, is our great domestic problem.
Just to finish off this thought, if I may, is it perhaps a corollary of all this that from now on, in this increasingly complicated world, the greatest parts of the time of maximum action for a president will not be in the first few years, but a little later on, as he has time to grasp this increasingly complicated world?
No, I think it'll be continuing. I don't see and I think I perhaps, before I came into the office, I saw it in a sense of a period and then slack. Mm-hmm. But I think we got a lot through the Congress in the first 2 years, and I think we can continue, and I think it's going to be a... Because of the pressure of world events on the United States, I would say that there will be... A president will be expected to not to rest on the momentum of the first 100 days or year or 2 years, but will be continuing.
Mr. President, in the light of the election returns, which at the congressional level at least were certainly a defeat for the Republican hopes, how do you measure your chances for significant success domestically in the Congress just ahead?
Well, I think we'll be in about the same position of the last 2 years. I think that, as I say, what we have that's controversial will be very closely contested.
Did the complexion of the House change a little bit by these shifts?
I would say it's slightly against us more than it was. We're not quite as good shape as we was for the last 2 years, but we're about where we were the last 2 years, which means every vote will be three or four votes either way, winning or losing.
Do you have a very crucial vote at the outset on this Rules Committee fight again, do you think?
I hope that the Rules Committee is kept to its present number, because we can't function if it isn't. We might as well, we're through if we lose, if they try to change the rules. Nothing controversial in that case would come to the floor of the Congress.
In other words, the
program, in my opinion, would be emasculated.
In other words, in the first 5 or 6 days of this session, we may have a swift answer as to the hopes
whether
of
we're going to get anything done for the next 2 years. That's right.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Keep looking at each other while I say something for just a minute. We've done 18 minutes here. I think the only key thing that we haven't done anything on is the Mississippi.
Could I please get a question about education?
Yes, well, I think we must test education.
Well, education.
Education, Mississippi, and then work toward an
amendment. Mr. President, power like charities, you know, it begins at home. And you seem to have one view of what we need to do at home, and Congress seems to have another view. A lot of money will be appropriated for defense and national security, but there's a certain reluctance to devote money to another form of capital investment, education, and other things like that at home. Is it purely a question of money, or is this religious thing really going to make it impossible for you to get any Education Act passed?
Well, education, it's certainly the question of how the funds will be distributed and how they will be shared is one of the factors. The integration question is another matter which comes into it. I think that, you know, Thomas Jefferson once said, to expect the people to be ignorant and free is to expect what never was and never will be. Here we're going to have twice as many people trying to go to college in 1970 as 1960. That means we have to build as many buildings in 10 years as we built the whole 160 years of our country's history. Then you've got these millions of young boys and girls who are dropping out of school, who are unskilled at a time when when skilled labor is needed and not unskilled. So we need money for vocational training to train them in skills, to retrain workers, to provide assistance funds for colleges, and then to provide assistance to those who are going to get doctorates, higher advanced in engineering, science, and mathematics. We have a severe shortage there, and yet we're asking for space, defense, and all the rest. The Soviet Union is concentrating on this. So all this requires funds, but it's all in controversy. Some people feel the federal government should play no role, and yet the federal government, since the Land Grant Act and back to the Northwest Ordinance, has played a major role. I think the federal government has a great responsibility in the field of education. We can't maintain our strength industrially, militarily, scientifically, socially, without a very well-educated citizenry. And I think the federal government has a role to play, so we're going to send up a program. Unfortunately, because of the fact, as you mentioned, and other reasons, we've come close to getting assistance to education passed, but we haven't been successful.
Is the problem entirely a question of funds and money? Even in the colleges that do exist, for example, it seems to me that every year fewer students go in for science and engineering courses, in spite of all the publicity about the technological race, in spite of your pleas. Is there anything that can be done or should be done morally or persuasively by
the president? Part of its motivation. And a lot of that is counseling and the interest of parents. Some of the things that we talk about here, I hope, will interest more of them. But there is a question of funds, particularly those who are going to get doctorates. They can get scholarships at college and then go on and get assistance to become doctors, doctors of science and engineering and so on. They need the funds. They can't stay in school 4 or 5 years. Most of them are married, and we lose them, and the country loses them. So it is at least the role that we can play. Funds are going to be important.
Mr. President, is your problem of getting an education bill through this year made more difficult by the events in Oxford, Mississippi, and the use of federal troops there?
Yes, I think so.
Well,
I think so.
Do you How will you combat this new...
Well, as I say, we've got once... this is a case of where we've come very close. President Eisenhower came close. We came close once. We got a bill through the House, through the Senate, almost through the House. We didn't get it. And another time for higher education through the Senate, the House, and then failed. The conference failed. Now Oxford, Mississippi, which has made this whole question of the federal government and education more sensitive in some parts of the country, I suppose that's going to be a factor against us. I don't really know what other role they would expect the President of the United States to play. The court, made up of Southern judges, determined that it was according to the Constitution that Mr. Meredith go to the University of Mississippi. The governor of Mississippi opposed it, and there was rioting against Mr. Meredith, which endangered his life. We sent in marshals, and after all, 150 or 60 marshals were wounded one way or another out of 400 or 500, and at least three-fourths of the marshals were from the South themselves. And then we sent in troops when it appeared that the marshals were going to be overrun. I don't think that anybody who looks at the situation could think we could possibly do anything else. But on the other hand, I recognize that it's caused a lot of bitterness against me and against the national government in Mississippi and other parts. And though they expect me to carry out my oath, Constitution, and that's what we're going to do. But it does make it more difficult to pass an education bill. But I think we shouldn't penalize this great resource of our youth for all these reasons. Instead, we ought to do the job and get some, and get these schools built, these teachers compensated, and higher education available to all these boys and girls. And every time I drive around the country, that's all you see are 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 year old children who are going to be pouring into our schools and colleges. And every governor will tell you that's his major problem, providing educational facilities. Well, the national government has a responsibility.
Mr. President, back before you were elected, your father used to have a favorite story he told reporters. He asked you once, why do you want the job? And he cited the reasons why you shouldn't want it. And you apparently gave him an answer. I don't know if it satisfied him, but apparently satisfied yourself. Would you give him the same answer today, after serving in this office for 2 years?
Oh, you mean that somebody's going to do it?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I think that the presidency, there's a lot of satisfactions to the presidency, because particularly if, as I say, we're all concerned as citizens and as parents and all the rest with all the problems we've been talking about tonight. They're all the problems which, if I wasn't president, I'd be concerned about as a father or as a citizen. So at least you have an opportunity to do something about them. And if you, and if what you do is useful and successful, then of course that's great satisfaction. When, as a result of a decision of yours, a failure comes or you're unsuccessful, of course that's a great setback. But I must say, after being here for 2 years and having the experience of the presidency, and there's no experience you can get that can possibly prepare you adequately for the presidency, I must say that I have a good deal of hope for the United States, just because I think that this country, which is, as I say, criticized itself and has criticized around the world, 180 million people for 17 years, really for more than that, for almost 20 years, have been the great means of defending first the world against the Nazi threat, and since then against the communist threat. And if it weren't for us, the communists would be dominant in the world today, and because of us, we're in a strong position. Now, I think that's a pretty good record for a country with 6% of the world's population, which is very reluctant to take on these burdens. And therefore, I think we should be satisfied with ourselves this Christmas.
Thank you very much, Mr. President.